10:50.
Chair, members of the board.
Good morning.
My name is Susan Cordell. I'm the director of the Institute of Pacific Island Forestry, which is part of the U.S. Forest Service. So last year when I gave this presentation, people wanted fancier copies than the ones you guys got. So I did bring them. I don't know if you still have interest this year to get the glossy ones, but I brought them for you.
Thank you.
I think it was Sam, actually.
No. I
did that.
It's always nice to see.
So just to remind you about what the experimental forest is, it's land that we are working with. We have a cooperative agreement with the state, with DLNR, and we have a 35-year cooperative agreement to have an overlay of an experimental forest on state land. So we have two parcels on the Big Island, as you see on page 2. This is in Laupahoehoe, which is a wet tropical forest, and then at Puvava, which is it spans from a dry forest to a music forest up at the Forest Bird Sanctuary. So the purpose of this is to fall into the National Experimental Forest and Range Network. So most every state has an experimental forest associated with the Forest Service, and Hawaii did not. And so as part of the Tropical Forest Recovery Act, this was stated as a necessary thing for Hawaii. So this was established in, I believe, 2006. And part of the requirement was to give an annual update to the DLNR, so that's why I'm sitting here in front of you today. So basically, you can read about the land area, how much land there is, and then I'll just go through some of the categories. The administration is through our office in Hilo, but we work in partnership with DOFA. Mostly on the Big Island. We have collaboratively put together a permitting process, so any applicant, this is open to anybody that wants to do research. It can be locally here within Hawaii or outside of Hawaii, outside universities. They apply for a permit, and we have a committee that looks through those permits to make sure they're in compliance with all of the rules, and to make sure that we feel it's important for the state of Hawaii to allow this, because obviously, you know, these are sensitive areas, and we want to make sure that the research is of importance for land management needs. We also have worked with community advisory councils. We work with the Puvava Advisory Council, as well as we created the Laupahoehoe Advisory Council. So these are community members that come together quarterly and discuss issues and needs associated with the experimental forest. You can see the staff here, as well as the DOFA staff, and part of this overlay is that the state is still expected to do the management that's required on these lands, and the research is done over and above that. We have several facilities that we utilize for this research. One is a purchased land called the Kahikina Learning Center in Laupahoehoe community. This we own. And we also work with the state to utilize the Puvava Lake House as well as the Meeting House. Some changes that are occurring in both of these right now are pretty exciting, actually, and I wanted to update you on that. The Kahikina Learning Center, working with the federal government can be challenging in terms of, you know, utilizing the space, and it's been very underused and sort of has that sort of perception of being behind locked gates in the Laupahoehoe community. We don't want this. And so in order to facilitate the community engagement as well as youth engagement in Hamakua, which is a very underserved area, we're partnering with Partners in Development Foundation, Malama Aina, Akaka Foundation, and DLNR to actually form a cooperative sort of hui to manage the Laupahoehoe for the Kahikina Learning Center. And Partners in Development Foundation in particular will actually run and maintain this facility. We're working through an agreement with the Forest Service and be able to expand their youth education activities significantly. So we're really excited about that. We're in the process of signing these documents and pushing them forward. And Puvava, another exciting development is that in the past we had funds to actually build a new facility, and we kept running into headaches of every different kind, and finally we had a smart person come on in the Forest Service that said, well, why don't we just renovate these structures that are state-owned? And so we felt, well, yeah, of course that makes sense, because these are beloved buildings and require a lot of maintenance. So we're now working with the state to improve these facilities. We're utilizing those funds, and we're going to put, I think, over $1 million of funds into renovation of these two facilities that are highly used. So very excited about that. This gives us no authority to have any oversight of those facilities. They continue to run as they've always run, so this is just being done through a partnership. Here you can look at some of the research summaries. To date, or since 2014, we've had 86 projects total initiated at the experimental forest sites. We have some very interesting range of research. One you can see here is looking at bark beetles, and they actually found a new species that hasn't been recorded since the 1980s. There's people at Puvavam mapping caves, miles and miles and miles of caves, and finding new discoveries there. So having this overlay has been really exciting and important for advancing research here in the state of Hawaii.
Where's the cave?
I don't have it in here, sorry.
No. Okay.
But if you ever get a chance to see the presentation of theirs, it's really amazing. They're just mapping miles and miles and miles of caves all through.
New cave species?
New cave species, as well as lots of bird bones that they're finding in there. You can look on page 7. This is the type of organizations that are doing research in the area and where they are. For example, Lapa-Hoihoi has a forest reserve and a natural area reserve. Puvava has a state park, a forest reserve, private land, and the forest bird sanctuary. So you can see how it's designated, and you can see down below that by far it looks like maybe University of Hawaii or other universities are carrying out most of the research. Forest Service also carrying out quite a bit of work as well. Moving on to the Kahikina Learning Center, we have an Ohia Common Garden. This was established to advance the Million Ohia Initiative, the Ulu Lehu Lehu. Basically, this started prior to ROD impacting our Ohia forests, but now it's becoming a really important resource for ROD because these varieties were brought to a common place from all over the island. And so there's huge genetic diversity that's being represented in this garden. And now it's a great resource to understand if we can find resistance to ROD utilizing this. So,
do you have ROD presently in this area?
Not in this particular area, but in Lapa-Hoihoi there has been documentation of ROD. It's not a hot spot, but there's definitely rapid Ohia death.
But not in Puvava yet.
Not in Puvava yet, thankfully. Unbelievably, actually.
No.
So anyway, this is a really exciting common garden. If you look at pages 9 and 10, these go through our outreach and exit activities, and we're pretty excited about how much enthusiasm we've gotten with some of the programs that we run. We work primarily with Kupu to have year-round interns and other interns and YCC camps through the summer to help with invasive species management. At the Puvava unit, if you look on page 12, you can look at figure number 4, number of participants from 2014 to 2018. You can see Puvava is a much more happening place than Lapa-Hoihoi with those numbers, number of participants, and this is what we're hoping to increase with our new partnership with the folks that I mentioned to you. Some great activities go on there. There's the biocultural blitz where 250 fourth graders around the island of Hawaii got educated on biological phenomenon at Puvava. And then you can see the Kahikina Learning Center, some of the activities we've done there. We recently had the Kupu Board of Directors have their annual meeting there. And then finally on the last page, we also are collecting long-term forest monitoring data. So we're looking at growth and mortality of our native forests, both at Puvava and Lapa-Hoihoi, and we're also collecting climate data as well. So we are providing annual summaries to you folks here with this. And, really important data is emerging right now. We're starting to show that mortality is actually related to an increase in minimum temperatures. So that means the minimum temperatures, in at least in Lapa-Hoihoi and Puvava, are getting higher. And so that's relating to tree mortality. So really showing that climate change is really starting to impact our forests. You can see on figure number 5, this is rainfall. And I just want to point out that August, the dotted line is 2018 rainfall. That August value is from Hurricane Lane. And this was a storm event where we had 761 millimeters of rain fall on August 23rd. I think this is probably a record. So, and then Puvava, you can see that too. And then we have a list of the citations that came out from last year. And I think that's all. So it's been a good year, and we're hoping to increase activity in the next years to come. So I look forward to reporting that to you. So if you have any questions.
Fantastic work. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, sounds like a lot of activity involving a lot of groups.
Yeah, no, it's been a great partnership so far.
On page 9, I don't see much forest in those pictures. I guess they're planting?
Page 9. Are they the kids?
Yeah, kids in pasture, it looks like.
Yes, yes. That is, in Puvava, there's a new project going on, community-based restoration. So working with the community to reforest the cinder cones. So pretty soon, hopefully, that picture will be able to do a time lapse, and you'll see co-op in there.
Awesome.
So that's our goal.
Can you talk a little bit about your climate change comment?
Oh, sure.
And is that it relates to your observations of research in biodiversity, its decrease or stabilization or increase in your case?
Well, the mechanism that we're proposing of what's happening is that as you increase nighttime temperatures or minimum temperatures, which occur in the nighttime or early morning, the trees, which are normally resting during that time, are respiring higher rates of respiration. So they're losing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, where rather than keeping it and turning it into sugars for growth. So this is a phenomenon that was first outlined in Costa Rica. They have a 30-year data set. Our data set's a little less than 10 years now, but we're starting to see a similar trend where they've found a strong relationship between that and tree mortality occurring. And so it's really the trees are respiring more and thus less able to make sugars with the carbon dioxide that they're bringing in. So it's offsetting the carbon balance of the tree is essentially what's going on. That's the proposed mechanism. Not sure what we can do about it, but just documenting it, I think, and understanding it is important. Increase our carbon sequestration.
Yes. Any questions? Other questions?
This was great. Thank you for preparing this.
Thank you very, very much. Is there any public testimony? No. Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I would like to,
would you like to comment? Yes, please do.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I just want to acknowledge the federal support for facilities.
Yes, it's been great. Yeah. Super. Okay. Anything else you want to say?
No, I
know you know a lot about this, so.
Yeah, yes.
If you want to emphasize anything, please go ahead.
Sure. Press the button and it's going to stop. I just wanted to make sure all of our board members know how beneficial this partnership has been for us and for the state. Our deteriorating facilities over at Puvava, the federal government through the Forest Service bringing in $1 million. And then we put in a lot of other money into helping fix the roads and stuff like that. The only reason we had to build the Tahikina Learning Center, which is named after Senator Kafka and his 1992 Forest Recovery Act, is because having problems with some of our in the forest, state forest and all. So the Forest Service, we bought 60 acres and building that. And we're going to use that as a basis for developing the further partnership that Dr. Cadell mentioned with Partners in Development, Malama Aina, U.S. Forest Service, the LNR, in extending the amount of education not only for the native forest but for Ohia and Ohia resilience development that we're partnering in. So it's a great partnership. And we're also moving that into a national forest system. So next week, Dr. Cordell will be meeting with the Forest Service regional leadership in moving forward on our multi-ecosystem national forest system that we will partner with them. So it'll allow for a lot more unique ecosystem science research. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, we're going to do C5 now. C5. Sorry.
Yay.
Yeah,
okay. Go ahead.
Aloha, Chair, members of the board. Katie Erspach, I'm with the Division of Forestry and Wildlife. Item C5 is seeking approval to acquire the Pu'ahala property. It's 800 acres of private lands on the island of Molokai. Acquisition of this land will allow for the following: completion of a 2,000-acre papuli fence that will protect some of the last remaining native forests in this area, as well as help recharge the Ualapu'e Aquifer, which is designated as Molokai's sole source aquifer. This acquisition will also protect the Kailua wetland located on the Makai side of the property, which provides habitat for numerous endangered water birds. Upon acquisition, DOFA plans to add the Mauka lands to the State Forest Reserve System and create a wildlife sanctuary, Makai. Natural resource management actions will take place across the entire Ahupua, and it may include trails and access, reforestation, as well as wetland management. I'd also like to add the community is very supportive of this acquisition, and we've been working for the past 4 years to make this happen, so we're excited to get to this final step. The community will also be involved in the creation of a future management plan for this area. The total purchase price is $3.19 million, and funding is coming from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Legacy Lands Program. And I'll let Ian comment a bit more about some of the due diligence that we've been working on.
Ian Hirokawa with Land Division. We assisted DOFA on the due diligence portion of the acquisition. I think there were just a couple things you wanted to bring to the board's attention in the submittal, but kind of wanted to stress. One was that, as per the title, there are certain kulianas within the property that we're purchasing, and there was an agreement, quiet-tail agreement with the owner of, I guess, the property we're purchasing, with the kuliana owners, and it required a designation of access easements for those kulianas. The landowner has worked to resolve and designate the easements. However, as part of the agreement, once you designate the easement, there's a trigger that the kuliana, I guess the landowner has option to buy the kuleana or force a sale, essentially. But what we want to make clear was that the board will, we're asking the board, like, we don't want to exercise that. You know, we don't want to force anybody to sell their kuleana if they don't want to. I mean, if they want to voluntarily one day approach us about it, that's fine. But we just want to make sure that we're not exercising that right, even though they're designated in the easements. We just want to resolve the access issue. Secondly, in regards to environmental, we did a phase one, and there were some wrecks on the property. The landowner did the work, cleaned up the wrecks, got in no further action determination from the Department of Health, agreed to our hazardous materials indemnification, the warranty deed. There's still some cleanup spots that did not rise to the level of the wrecks, and because the landowner has gone through, you know, done a lot of work, DOFA has agreed to clean those up post-closing. Finally, on the southeast corner of the property, on the Makai side, there's a the landowner has a submerged land lease with the state. The original intent was to develop a small boat harbor marina, as part of the larger development of the property. The landowner wants to mutually cancel the lease with the state because, you know, once they sell the property, they'll be completely sort of out of the area and they don't want to have the lease anymore. We're okay with that, but the issue is there's a third party neighboring landowner that has some encroachments on the property that the state is going to buy and potentially the lease area. We're not too sure because the overlays aren't quite, they don't look quite accurate on the, in order to resolve this issue, DOFA will go out there and sort of stake the boundaries themselves to get a sense of, okay, where these encroachments are, and work with the landowner and the neighbor to have them cleaned out before we close the acquisition, have them relocated on the neighbor's private property. From Land Division is worth it. We're okay with that, provided as long as when the lease is terminated, that the submerged land lease premises returns to us clean. So prior to closing, as long as those encroachments are resolved, we're okay.
Great. Okay. Questions, comments?
Ian, when you say the access easement issue and the pursuit of a possible purchase to the Culiacan lands, how is that codified? Is that in the conveyance document that we would not pursue? Where is that?
Well, it's originally in an agreement signed by all the landowners. I guess it could be further placed in the deed. We were just thinking a decision from the board as part of the record would be sufficient to, you know, for the Culiacan owners to rely on.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that one of the recommendations? Is it specific condition in the staff recommendation?
I think we have it. No, it's not a specific recommendation. It's in the body of the submittal, and I think we just ask that the board approve it to all the, you know, terms and conditions discussed herein. So be incorporated.
Now, okay.
If I'm make a specific, that's fine.
I do know that when we're considering prior board actions, we often are given the action item itself, the recommendation that comes from the staff, and that the rest of the body of the thing is usually presented in support of that recommendation. I really like it when any important conditions such as that one are placed in that staff recommendation, so that anyone, you know, looking at the record later will find it easily and can be assured that the state has no intention of pursuing.
Yeah, so, and I'm sorry, I should have caught this before, but the paragraph, paragraph one, authorized the acquisition of the subject private lands under the terms and conditions cited above. I think what the land board would like is for you to outline, rather than, because otherwise when you're reading through the submittal, you can't quite tell what's sort of background information versus a term and condition.
Ian, this fence that you're going to put up, there's no fence now. You're going to, your proposed fence you're going to put in. Or is there a fence?
Correct. We're starting the construction now.
You're starting the construction?
Not on this part of this property, but the fence itself extends eastward. So there's about four or five other landowners that are involved in the construction of that particular fence. So we're starting on the eastern edge.
How high is the fence?
Above the cliff, yeah.
It varies. It's about 1,600 feet. It skirts the conservation.
No,
district.
I mean the height of the fence alone.
Oh, excuse me. It's about 7 to 7.5 feet.
Okay.
Deer fence.
Correct.
Chris.
The submerged lands lease. Document says they're supposed to pay us $8,500 a year. You been paying for this?
You check the rent. The rent is current. I don't recall what it is now, but yeah, it's the rent is current.
Have they been exercising any rights in the area?
No. Well, aside from no, I mean, if anything, any what I call quote unquote use of that area is like by the community or the neighbors. I don't see anything that the landowner has actually done to the land. It's just been...
They didn't really... I mean, it looks to me like there was some dredged area in there. No? Or is that a fish pond?
I think that's a former fish pond. There's a... Because it's a freestanding parcel. The lease, even though it's submerged, yeah, it actually is a freestanding parcel. Yeah, it's a TMK assigned to it.
All right. Now, the appraisal was for the 800 acres and did not include any. We're not paying for cancellation of the lease.
No.
Anything.
No.
We're just,
yeah,
canceling.
Just usually.
Yeah. Okay. That's all.
When was the lease executed?
I think originally it was 69, I think.
Yeah, 69.
1969.
Back when we would have thought that putting a marina in there wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, it's definitely a dreams of the past.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Oh wait, oh now I forgot what it was. Are there any plans by the community to restore the fish ponds that are associated with the coastal portion of the Afufwa?
Not that we know of at this time, but that's a conversation we're going to be having with the members of the community.
Awesome.
Okay, any other questions? Is there a public testimony? Want to add something? Come on up.
Mm-hmm. Aloha, everyone.
Aloha.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Dr. Stephanie Dunbar-Cole. I am the East Slope Project Manager with the Nature Conservancy and the East Molokai Watershed Partnership. And we submitted written comments, but I wanted to fly down and provide a summary of those comments in person. I was raised on the east end of Molokai, actually not too far down the road from Pu'ahala. And Pu'ahala has a devastating history of failed development. And Mr. Yuen, you mentioned seeing dredging, and that's absolutely the case. And that was back in the late 60s. And this failed development is really clearly remembered by many members in our community. And it's in large part because of this history that the community is supportive of the department's acquisition and the department's desire to do conservation in the area. This support became really clear during our outreach for the Pakui Fence Project, which happened over many, many years. And included a considerable amount of outreach with community in Pu'ahala and adjacent Ahupua. The Pakui fence includes 8 Ahupua, so it was a significant outreach effort in our moku on the east end of Molokai. And what became very clear again during that outreach was support for this acquisition and support for a conservation vision in that area. Additionally, I led the botanical surveys in Pu'ahala in 2015, and I was really surprised by how healthy the Malka forests in that area are, given that there has never been management in that area. And in fact, through these surveys, we found that Pu'ahala contains some of the most intact forest left in East Molokai, and that it harbors many threatened and endangered species, a few of which we thought to be extinct on island. You know, and to me, what those surveys really indicated or underscored was that there's a lot to protect in Pu'ahala, and conversely, a lot to lose. The department's acquisition of this land, its restoration of the coastal areas, and inclusion of its native forests in the East Molokai Watershed Partnership's Pakui Fence Unit will help save these resources and all the good that comes from that. And that has strong support from the Nature Conservancy, the East Molokai Watershed Partnership, and the East Molokai community. Mahalo.
What's your management plan to remove the uglets in there, the deer, the pig?
It's a long one.
And what about the public's reaction to say it's my gathering right to do it?
Sure. So this was why this particular project took years of outreach. It was extremely important to all of us, myself included, and when I say all of us, I speak for the Nature Conservancy and the East Molokai Watershed Partnership. All of us are either born or raised on Molokai. So this was not light. And this is the first time that the Watershed Partnership was doing conservation in Manai, East Molokai. So this was a situation where the community wasn't familiar or as familiar with our work, and there was a lot of trust building that needed to happen. And so that involved numerous community meetings. We partnered with the Ahakiole o Molokai, and had over a dozen public, large community meetings. Sentiment was spread, but overall, there was consensus to support this work, to support conservation. And getting to your question about gathering rights and hunting, one of our real interest in the Pakuli area. So this is Puahala to Kaluaha, and it's those Ahupua'a, is because not only is the forest in those areas intact and really a continuation of the montane wet forest that you see in Kamako, Pelikuno, Olokui, but because there was very little hunting happening in the area. This is super steep. And so most of the hunting that occurs in those Ahupua occur below the forest line. And so for all of us, and we have a community advisory group to meet and discuss. For that group, for the community at large, for the Watershed Partnership and the Nature Conservancy and all of our agency partners, DLNR, Pakui made a lot of sense. It provided an opportunity for us to begin conservation work in Manai. And to have it have the most chance of success. So it is with a tremendous amount of joy that the Pakui fence started 2 weeks ago. We and many others went through a lot of trouble to make sure that that fence was being built by Molokai people. And so we have the CIP money that funded the construction of the fence that has gone to a watershed fence crew. This is the first state-funded watershed fence crew on Molokai. And it's been hired, and it's been filled by people who live in East Molokai.
I feel compelled to just, I want to make sure that we distinguish between hunting and traditional and customary gathering rights, because those are really two different things, and I'm just wanting to make sure we don't conflate those. I appreciate your answer very much, and looks like we're on a very, very good path here. Other questions?
Comments? So, you know, you pointed out that during your survey, the top was remarkably intact, and you answered the question, right? You probably attribute it to the amazing topography of that area. So I noticed the huge gulches to either side, and then the somewhat less complex but still pretty rough planes between them, where Puahala exists. I think that's an amazing thing. I would love to be there myself one of these days.
And I think on that note, it's the topography has definitely reduced animal movement in that area, but there are absolutely animals there, and you see pockets of that. But yeah, in following up, I was surprised at how the majority of the forest is very intact.
Is your family one of the eight adjacent Ahupua'a involved in the Pahu events?
No.
You're still a little bit further that way, yeah. I thought so. I was looking for the names. Yeah. I was looking for Kainolo in the list of Ahupua'a there. But my copy was a little bit, it was hard to read them. That looks like really rough country to try to build a fence in.
It is. But, you know, I made it a point to be on every single fence route survey. And so I can say, as I'm still sitting here today, that it's doable.
I highly
recommend spike tabis.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that it's not straight, which is like a sign that people have actually been on the ground and figured out where to put that route.
Is there a fence on the Mauka side, the very top?
There's not. No. That's a great question. The pali there is very steep. That said, there are incursion points, and you can see a couple of ridges that extend down into Wailao where you could see an intrepid animal being able to get up.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is we are going to include it in the construction of the Pakui fence is a wait and see, and if we do believe that we are getting incursion, we have identified two locations to build short strategic fencing over those ridges so that animals cannot come up from the north shore to the south shore over the Pali. And we think that that will be sufficient. You know, the consequence of building a fence along the East Molokai summit is not something that we're willing to do at this point.
Because of the disturbance involved. What is there a name of the peak where the Pakui fence finally achieves the summit once again?
Yes, Kalua'aha. Kalua'aha, So on the far east.
Mm-hmm.
Right before Mapalehu.
Yeah,
Kalua'aha. Large Mapalehu Valley.
Oh, so does that go up the ridge that goes up Mapalehu to the Wailau summit?
No, are you referring to the trail?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's on the eastern side of Mapalehu Valley.
Okay, so on the next ridge over.
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing. Well, this is going to be really amazing. For the staff, I have one last suggestion. Go ahead.
No, how far is it to the, roughly?
To Mapalehu Trail?
Yeah.
From where the fence is?
No, from the eastern edge of the Apua.
Just so I know that I understand you, how far is the eastern edge of Kalua'aha to the Mapalehu Trail?
Yeah.
Good. You know, I don't know if I could tell you that right off the bat. An eighth of a mile. What's in between Kalua'aha and the Mapalehu fence is the large Mapalehu Amphitheater Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you're not walking from the fence to Mapalehu Trail without hitting the highway first.
Yes. Okay.
Staff did a good job in preparing the material, the background material for the thing, and I suppose they pulled it from various other resources that were available for that. But I'm going to point out a favorite pet peeve of mine. You were very careful to say the most intact and native-dominated forest that you might find on the top, but the submittal called it the most pristine remaining. And in my mind, pristine is a word that's thrown out too often and too easily nowadays. And I would definitely have called it the most intact and native-dominated, but I would not have called it pristine. So, because as you point out, there have been changes in the landscape that affect the intactness of the forest up there. And even the extinction of Molokai's birds would have changed the nature of the vegetation via pollination relationships that have disappeared, etc. So, I just wanted to point out the pet peeve. That's it. I'm not going to make
any. That's yours.
That's my pet
that's
peeve.
That's yours.
But I'm going to point it out every time I see it from now on. So, staff, be aware of that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there other public testimony? Okay.
Then it was with great joy that I would like to move that we accept staff recommendation.
All right.
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. There you go.
Thank Yay.
You very much. Thanks for all your hard work on it.
Molokai is already turning into a leader in Ahupua'a management.
We're
going to
do K2 next.
K2. That's true. But hey, Young Design is really good at it too. K2.
Okay, now for the boring stuff.
Oh, this is amazingly exciting.
Don't let him say that.
Yeah.
We put a lot into that.
That's true.
Was it meant to? About your professionalism. Okay, Sam Lemo, Office of Conservation and Coastal Lands, Chair of Board Members. This is a CDUP for a single family residence, subsistence agriculture, landscaping. And I'd like you to authorize their agroforestry management plan, which is. You don't actually see a plan here, but all the things in the staff report are essentially the agroforestry management plan. Pretty straightforward case in my estimation. It's a single family residence of about 4,500 square feet. Located in, this is in Opokipuna on the Big Island. It's about a 9-acre parcel. So the home would be developed about 160 feet from the shoreline. So it seems to be well out of the area which we would consider coastal hazard. They're going to install a water tank, 10,000-gallon water storage tank, and an individual wastewater system, IWS. In addition to the home, they're proposing to establish a 6-acre agroforestry area. They're going to hand clear the land to prepare for the agroforestry use. They're going to do it in compartments of 1 to 1.5 acre segments. They're going to bring in some goats to help keep the land cleared, and they're going to install this so-called timeless electric fencing. My understanding is that the timeless electric fencing will not be around the perimeter of the property. It will be used to contain the goats while the goats are doing their thing, and then they're going to move the fencing and the goats around the property, sort of.
Rotational grazing.
Mm-hmm. They would also like to develop a 765 square foot shed on the property to store equipment, tools, and supplies to support the agroforestry project. So we ran it through the typical process for these types of things. They did do a draft environmental assessment. Chair issued a FONSI on that. We consulted with the county, and we don't see any major red flags with this particular use. There are homes in the area, so it's not as if it's a pristine. Sorry.
I agree.
You agree?
It's definitely not.
I don't know. Maybe it's unique, but yeah. So we're recommending that you accept staff recommendation for the home and the ancillary uses that I described earlier.
Okay, questions, board members?
I will comment that it's very rare that you hear Sam Limo that say that this is a straightforward proposal.
Okay, no questions. Did you want to add anything?
No, my name is James Leonard. I'm agent for Mike Moore. And just to say that Mike is deployed right now and wasn't able to make the meeting, but he's gone over the conditions and in full agreement with the conditions.
That was my question.
Great. Any public testimony on this?
Is this the Moore's primary residence? Will this be the...
This
residence?
Will be,
okay.
Yes.
Agroforestry, not to go into too much detail, but there we go. I see the listing. That's right, I recall that now. Thank you.
Okay. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
In favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move to J4.
I'm the Assistant Administrator for the Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation. Item J4 is asking for approval to initiate rulemaking proceedings, including public hearings to amend Hawaii Administrative Rule Section 13256-73 for Kaneohe Ocean Waters to clarify commercial activity provisions and make amendments for organizational purposes. Just a short little background. In 2011, Dobor implemented, administrative rules using the Kanyo Bay Master Plan as guidance. It was later found that there was an inadvertent error in HAR section 13-256-73Q. The result has led to incorrect interpretation that there's an educational or not-for-profit permit that exists. The intent was not to create a separate type of permit, and this rule amendment will address that issue. And I'm here for any questions.
Okay, any questions? Let's go to public testimony, and then if we have any follow-up questions, you can ask them.
Good morning, Chair Case, board members. My name is Andy Carey. I work for Kalamina Kids, so just representing Kalamina Kids. Our testimony would be that we would support the proposed revisions to the Hawaii Administrative Rules Section 13-256-73, with the exception of removing subsection Q, just because eliminating subsection Q would seem to prohibit nonprofit educational programs on Kaneohe Bay conducted by, bona fide 501c3 nonprofit organizations such as Kalamina Kids. Kalamina Kids has been the caretaker and steward of Hei'ia State Park now since 2010, and that's a role that we're extremely grateful and proud to, be able to care for the park and make many improvements and make it a clean and safe place and offer educational programs for the community and for the kids through Hei'ia State Park. And across all of Kalamina Kids programs, nearly 10,000 children and families daily, over 1,200 employees and 100 locations statewide, from Kauai to the Big Island. Since 1987, the company Kalamina Kids' main focus is providing quality educational programs for children and families in the community. And just since 2010, since we have been the caretaker of Hei'ia State Park, offering programs there that are educational regarding Hawaii's culture and ecology and ocean safety. And our concern is that by removing subsection Q from the administrative rules would eliminate opportunities for bona fide 501c3 nonprofit organizations such as Kalamina Kids to be able to provide those type of environmental education programs on the bay, especially with so many persisting problems and just this day and age with pollution and climate change and threat to coral reef and things of that nature, all the more critical and all the more reason we do want the ability to offer programs that teach our youth to have the proper respect and be good stewards for the environment and for the culture, and do that experientially, actually on the bay, and teach ocean safety as well. Kalamina Kids has been able to operate under that provision of subsection Q, which does allow for bona fide educational organizations that are recognized by the state of Hawaii and the IRS as 501c3 nonprofit organizations. That provision was created I believe in 1991 by the Kaneohe Bay Regional Task Force in conjunction with DLNR, and has always been upheld by previous boards. And again, our concern just now that eliminating it now would jeopardize Kalamina Kids and other similar nonprofit educational organizations from having the opportunity to conduct marine education programs, and so doing deprive Hawaii's children and community of educational opportunities and experiences on the bay.
Thank you for pointing out your concern. I will point out that this item before us initiates rulemaking proceedings, including the public hearings.
Yes.
So that there'll be many opportunities to offer the details of the rulemaking.
So we should have been safer.
No. It's good to anticipate what the reaction will be in public hearing. And so thank you for for taking the time to point out that there's, you know, that there are items in here that you or other members of the public will probably point out during the, those hearings.
And if the board has any questions or anything.
Yeah, what are the organizations or activities that undermine the, what is the original intent of subsection Q? I get yours, so what are you aware of the other ones? Or?
No, in other words, other organizations that would, no, I'm not.
Okay.
No.
How many seats do you have per day under your nonprofit operation?
I believe 152 is the current capacity.
Did you want to add anything?
I did. Thank you very much, Chair. Board members, Greg Kugel. I'm the attorney for Carolina Kids. And I appreciate Board Member Gomes' concern about this. But what I wanted to call out for the board members was really there is a kind of an underlying legal issue here, and that goes to why we don't think you should initiate rulemaking. But our focus really is on that subsection Q that Andy mentioned. But just by way of history, in the 1990s, the state legislature passed a statute that said there was concern about Kaneohe Bay. We'll create a task force to come up with regulations for the bay. That task force went through, and it predated my time, and I think for most of the members of the board, we're not on the board at that time either, but predated many of us. This task force went through a very, at times, divisive but ultimately constructive process to come up with a Kaneohe Bay master plan, which it did in the early 1990s. That the state law also required that the land board at that time, pursuant to the master plan, adopt a set of regulations governing the use of Kaneohe Bay. And that did come to pass too, and that's how we got all of subsection 73, including provisions P and Q, which have been in the regulations for many, many years. And there's two provisions that have to be read kind of in conjunction. Subsection P says that there shall be no new commercial activities on the bay other than those that existed in 1993 at the time these regulations came into effect. And then there is, of course, the provision that we're talking about today that is the counterpart, the sister component of that prohibition, which says that activities conducted by a bona fide nonprofit organization that's registered with the IRS under 501c3 and that is recognized by the state of Hawaii, those prohibitions don't apply to such a nonprofit. Now, Kamaya Kids, as Andy described, has been on the bay for since before these regulations were in effect, originally operating out of Heia State Park, then down at Kokokahi Wai, and then ultimately when this board granted Kamaina Kids the lease for Heia State Park in 2010, they have been the stewards of the park ever since. And over all those years, they've been conducting a myriad of activities on the bay. Now, since 2016, Dobor and Kamaina Kids have been in discussions over the scope of their activities on the bay, and there's been some disagreement about what that is. that ultimately led to a cease and desist letter earlier this year about certain activities, which Kamaina Kids has acknowledged, and I think there was a report given to the Kaneohe Bay Regional Council a month ago that DoCare confirmed that that is in fact true. However, because Kamaina Kids doesn't necessarily agree with that conclusion, we have appealed that decision, and that is going to go through a contested case process. And central in that case, certainly the history that I just described to you, but will be the operation of subsections P and Q and how those relate to Kamaina Kids' activities. And that will ultimately, if the board acts as it has done before on contested cases, you'll refer it to a hearings officer. There will be evidence. There will be testimony about the nature of activities, about how subsection P and Q and all of the administrative regulations came into effect. And then ultimately how that impacts what Gilmore has done or not done in this case. And so I think what I wanted to inform the board is that the proposal before you to drop Q out, while that is specifically a significant issue in contention in this soon-to-come contested case hearing, is, in my opinion, just an effort to kind of unlevel the playing field or to change the rules midstream. Now, there's lots of reasons why, even if we go through a contested case, you can't just change the rules in the middle of the contested case. But again, I think that the only reason for targeting subsection Q is to target Carmina kids. And I don't think there is any other nonprofit that is intended to be the target. So that's our concern with the proposed rulemaking that's before you today. And so I wanted to kind of explain that background so that you can make informed decisions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have some questions when I'm still thinking this one through. This is a little more complicated than I thought it was coming in. Just give me a little background on commercial use in Conneaut Bay. So P says there's no increase. Does that mean you had to have be operating in 1993? Or does it mean that there's no increase in the level of operations, but the operators can be different?
The way that the master plan originally and then the regulations, it took the existing users in 1993, the existing commercial users. So at the time there were jet skis, parasailing, glass bottom boats, a whole hierarchy of different uses that are reflected in the old version of subsection 73. And it said, for instance, and I'm going to get this wrong, but one permit for a 250 passenger boat will be allowed, and that can perpetuate. And there were lower levels of permits as well for existing commercial activity, because there's an obvious concern that if you flat out tell everybody who's been legally doing a business that they can no longer operate, that raises constitutional problems. So the rules enshrine certain commercial uses which were reflective of existing uses on the bay in 1993 when the rules came into effect. There were entities like Carmina Kids, and I don't know if in the 1990s there were others, who were providing, who were bona fide 501c3 nonprofit organizations who were providing educational opportunities both on the bay and on land. And Carmina Kids obviously is in schools and other things. But with respect to the bay, provision Q was in there to, in our mind, and it's my opinion, was there to say, we're not regulating bona fide 501c3 nonprofit educational activities that occur on the bay. And all the restrictions in Section 73 that say, you know, no new jet skis, no new parasailing, or all these things, was there to restrict the commercial activity and those commercial operators. But subsection Q was put in there to make clear that nonprofits could continue and weren't subject to the restrictions that commercial operators are, and nonprofits could continue their
education. So your interpretation is that your interpretation of Q is that there are no restrictions that apply to nonprofits, nonprofit operators.
There certainly are. Nonprofits have to obviously, be a 501c3 nonprofit. They file 990s. They're regulated by the IRS. They also file on a recognized by the state of Hawaii.
But as far as activities on the bay, your interpretation of Q would be that there's no restrictions on what. In other words, you could have jet skis on the bay.
Well,
and it would not be restricted.
I don't know, because that's certainly not what Carmina Kids does. I think subsection Q talks about specifically educational opportunities. If there's a touchstone to what the limits are, it's probably around that.
Could a nonprofit run commercial tours? and use the money to fund its nonprofit business?
I think I'm not a tax lawyer. I recall when Kamehameha Schools was under scrutiny by the IRS, they cut out some of their commercial entities, such as the Royal Hawaiian Shopping Center and other things, which clearly would have threatened their nonprofit status with the IRS.
But your interpretation of Section Q, would that allow a nonprofit 501c3 to run commercial tours?
I interpret Provision Q to say that as long as the Internal Revenue Service believes that what they are providing is a nonprofit, legitimate nonprofit educational opportunity, then it's covered by subsection Q.
Just to add to that, my kind of understanding was that, you know, for the programs that Kamehameha Kids had previously operated, before this language was put in, that, you know, at the time, you know, Kamehameha Kids, an educational nonprofit organization without a commercial permit, that subsection Q was, you know, kind of the justification for Kamehameha Kids continuing to receive the HORMA decals and continuing to be, you know, recognize the boats that we did use, not to add jet skis and, you know, all kinds of other different operations, but for the activities that we did offer at the time.
How many was that?
So I think it was increased to 152 in like 1996, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I think before then it was 9 less.
That's when you were in the east side of the bay.
At Kohukahi, yes. But yeah, just that you know, subsection was what allowed Kamehameha Kids to operate those programs with those specific boats and still receive, you know, the ORMA decals and still, you know, kind of be recognized as a legitimate operation, although not a commercial operation that needed a commercial use permit, is my understanding.
Yeah, this is a really difficult area because you can have a legitimate nonprofit, what I would call a legitimate nonprofit, have an educational tour and charge people money to go on it just to cover your expenses, and the people get salaries. You can also use this as a business model where you, instead of having a business, you have a nonprofit and you pay yourself to be the head of the nonprofit. I'm not saying that that's what you're doing, but this is the Q loophole that they're trying to close up. I think maybe the jet ski and parasail thing is not really a question because the ORMA rules don't allow that. So we don't really have to worry about that level or that type of commercial activity. I'm going to ask staff, because staff says that other sections of 256 separate this out and allow the educational and nonprofits. And I'm going to ask them how they're drawing the line here, because I think it is a tough line to draw, and I do think that, you know, you could have a educational program that just does charge something, and that makes it what commercial.
Why don't we hear the rest of the public testimony, okay, and then you can ask the questions of staff.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your time.
Good afternoon already. Almost there. Morning, board members. My name is Joe Picker. I own a company called Sea Hawaii. We were one of the original commercial operators on Kaneohe Bay. So my brother and I have been operating there since 1989. So I think we were the third commercial business that established the original bay. Full service operator, jet skis, scuba diving, and all of the different toys. And when we started, it was unregulated. There was no rules. Nothing was in place to say how many people you could take out on your tours on a daily basis. The
there was no restrictions on the type of activities. There was never parasailing. One thing that was never allowed on the bay was because the air patterns were kind of a marine base. The Marines would have heartburn if anybody was putting anything up in the flight pattern of the jets landing and taking off at the Marine base. So that was never permitted on the bay. There were people operating from Kualoa Ranch, Schrader's Resort, and the harbor. Those were the only areas where people were operating commercial activities. The community started getting a lot of heartburn with the number of buses that were being brought down to the bay. The restrooms were getting overwhelmed. The parking was getting taken up by all of the vendors, the workers. So Mike McCartney created the act that said that we're going to have this Kaneohe Task Force. And I was one of the original members of the task force. We were all, I think, appointed by the governor at the time. And the commercial operators elected me to be their representative on the board. I think we had 11 members. Neighborhood board, Green Base, everybody was there. And it was a very contentious 3 years. We were all had our own positions. There was only one commercial representative on the board, that was me. And I know all about what happened. I was the person that helped write that language about nonprofits. And this is generally what happened. We were out there, and the community had had enough. Some companies were taking over 300 people a day out on the tours. And if you look at the pier, it was just getting overwhelmed. I even thought that. And I said, they're going to come shut us down. So there was an effort by some people who I was adversaries with at the time, John Rapoon, who became a very good long-term friend of mine, Amy Lewerson. It had John Goody, who was a chairman, who was a very credible guy, Peter Nottis from the Yacht Club. And we all got together for 2.5 years and fought about this issue. And the main purpose of the task force was to address the issues of commercial operations on the bay. Other things came up, but that was basically it. And as we went through the survey, we looked at every single activity that was being conducted on the bay from a commercial standpoint. And we identified them in the task force plan. All the people operating again from the harbor, Schrader's Resort, and Kualoa Ranch. At no time ever was Kamaʻaina Kids ever considered a commercial operation. They were operating from Kokokahi, as it was indicated. And they had a small activities, and I was there. And all they were doing was taking out kids to learn how to sail from Kokokahi's activities. So we surveyed them, we talked to the yacht club, who had activities, and we talked to the canoe clubs, all of these supposed nonprofits. At no time was any of these people bringing in tourists from Waikiki. At no time were any of these activities advertising themselves as commercial operations on the internet. At no time did they have brochures that they were distributing. At no time did they have buses or vans coming in from Waikiki. So they were not considered a commercial operation. They were simply a community service organization. And all they were doing was, if somebody wanted to go out to the bay for a certain purpose that met the community's nonprofit needs, so be it. So we inserted that language in the master plan with the intent of not preventing people like the Native Hawaiian Civic Club or the Canoe Club or the Polynesian Voyaging Society from using the bay as a resource, because we didn't want to have that hurt the community who was concerned primarily about commercial activities. So in the plan, we identified all the commercial operators. And we said, okay, some people who were doing 300 were ratcheted back to 150. My company was doing a little bit over 100. We were ratcheted back to 70. The number of boats that we were allowed to use was on a specific list. And we said, as of July 1, 1993, there was to be no proliferation, no expansion of commercial activities on the bay. And that meant bringing in tourists, advertising yourself as a business, whether or not you're owned by a nonprofit or not. No more commercial activities were supposed to be allowed in the bay. And I believe there was a law that was passed in 1993, and I think that's the reason why they had that date that said no more commercial activities allowed, and those are the limits. All, as the year went by, people were using this nonprofit language to sort of get around the restrictions of commercial activities. They would disguise themselves as nonprofits. They would go out and get in a van and say, I'm a 501c3. I can launch my canoe from whatever beach I want to that was public access and conduct commercial activities. And that's what people are doing now. And that's the reason why I believe, even though I don't want to hurt any nonprofits in the Bay, it's a good effort that the harbors, I mean, Boating is making to close this loophole. Because if not, what would prevent me? I have a COA foundation. My brother and I put money in our foundation. We're a 501c3. We do things that help the environment. You know, if somebody wants to do a beach cleanup, we buy some lunches. If somebody at the University of Hawaii wants to do a small study, we do that. What would prevent me from saying, okay, I'm a 501c recognized organization, and I'm going to go and advertise in Japan, come to Hawaii, and for a day, I'll talk for 30 minutes. I'll talk about, you know, it's a beautiful bay, it's a barrier reef, there's all the great research, and then take 1,000 people a day to go ride my jet skis. That's not the intent of that particular section. The intent was to take legitimate, non-for-profit organizations that operate in the community in the best interest of the community to provide access to the bay. And again, people are disguising themselves as nonprofits. And that's, in my mind, that was not the intent of what the Kaneohe Bay Task Force was created for. And that was not the intent of all of the proposals being made and the administrative rules that were implemented to prevent abuses of the bay. Because if not, everybody's going to do it. Everybody's going to do it. And it's going to destroy the bay, which is the reason why the Kaneohe Bay Task Force was originally created. It was to protect the bay and to prevent the proliferation of commercial activities so that it doesn't overwhelm the resource. So I support what the Boating Division is doing. It's probably the first time I think I ever said that.
You on record now.
However, I still do believe there needs to be some language inserted that protects the legitimate use of the bay by nonprofits. We don't want to cut out the Native Hawaiian Civic Club. We don't want to cut out the canoe club. If the Polynesian Voyage Society wants to come into the bay to go to Koloa Park, which is historically where they used to bring the canoe into, we don't want to prevent those types of activities from being allowed in the bay. But for people that are abusing it, abusing this section to run commercial operations, to bring in tourists, to expand activities, I don't believe that's what that was not the intent. And that's what people are doing. And I was there from the beginning. So if people come up and say, oh, we think this, I was there. I helped write every single rule and every single paragraph in that master plan that deals with commercial activities. Me along with the other members of the task force. And I'm willing to answer whatever question. I know there's going to be rulemaking, and I'll show up and testify there. But it's really unfortunate that people are using that section to run commercial activities and get around what the task force was all about. Personally, I think that's wrong.
Can I ask one?
Sure.
Back in 93, was Kamaaina Kids, did they charge a fee for kids sailing?
I don't even remember them being on this. I've known Ray Sandman for years. I've known his partner Victor Lozano for years. They were not even. Again, we surveyed everybody.
I thought you said they were taking people sailing.
They had an activity that was running out of Kopokahi YWCA.
Yes.
And they had little catamarans,
yes,
like Hobie Cats, and they were running activities there.
Oh.
And we looked at it and said, this is not even anything of significance. It's not a commercial activity. Wow. They're not bringing in tourists. So we documented it.
Yeah.
But they were not operating from Hayes State Park. Carol McLean had the operation there. We spoke to all these people. We went down and visited all of the operators. We viewed all the activities. And they were not even on the scene back then. No matter what somebody says, they were not even, I was there the whole time. We didn't even know their name back then.
Would you draw a bright line on charging people to go out on the water as how we view commercial versus non-commercial? Or do you think that there's
the Polynesian Voyager Society is running a program with Wyndham Community College, and they're charging the students to participate in a program at Kualoa Beach Park, for instance. And if that's construed as charging, I'm okay with that. I think the community is okay with that. Mm-hmm. But if somebody goes out and advertises on the internet, right, brochures in Waikiki, and they're saying, come out and ride our kayaks on the bay, that is definitely a commercial activity. And I think that's not what the task force intended, commercial, you know, that type of activity to be.
Thank you.
Aloha, co-chair and members of the board.
Hi, aloha.
I'm sharing my testimony. My name is Dealoha Rocky Talohiva, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Ahamoku Advisory Committee on Lokopuni Island of Kakuiheva, Oahu, and the Moko Opola Poko, which encompasses the Ahapua of Keia, Kaneohe, Kailua, Mokapu, Wamanalo, Kahalu'u, Kahe'e, Ka'alaya, Waihahole, Pekane, Kipu'u, and Kualoa. We strongly support the above stated request of the Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation. We humbly ask that the land board approve the initial rulemaking proceedings, including public hearings, to amend the current Hawaii administration rules as it pertains to Kaneohe Bay ocean waters. The purpose of the request is to clarify existing commercial activity regulations for the bay. For many years now, 9 of the 11 ahapua in Kaneohe have customarily been used for traditional and cultural purposes and worked to protect and sustain the natural and cultural resources. However, all have been deeply concerned about the commercial enterprises who claim that they are educating the public on the history and culture of Kaneohe Bay, yet are charging people for the privilege of boarding their vessels, whether they are catamarans, thrill craft, or kayaks. The communities of these ahapua'a, including the actual cultural and lineal descendants of these lands, do not know what is being taught to the tourists and about their history, their culture, and their lives. For the following reasons, we urge this esteemed land board to approve the submittal of Go Board to amend HR 13-256-73, Kaneohe Bay Ocean Waters to clarify commercial activity provisions. Pursuant to Act 208 SLH 1990, the legislator established that the Kaneohe Bay Master Planning Task Force establish a comprehensive master plan for Kaneohe Bay, in which I was also part of the planning. 1,500 hours our community took to write that. The Kaneohe Bay Master Plan was developed by the Office of State Planning on May of 1992 to address the critical need of protecting and sustaining the natural and cultural resources of Kaneohe Bay, and was developed through existing public participation, including fishermen, commercial and recreation businesses, neighborhood boards, state agencies, representatives from the Marine Corps Air Station, and the City and County of Honolulu. The foundation of the master plan was to protect sustainable uses of the natural and cultural resources of Kaneohe Bay, while at the same time address the needs of other uses of the bay. In 2013, under Hawaii Revised Statutes Title 12, Conservation and Resources, Section 200, Ocean Recreation and Coastal Areas Programs, 200-39, Kaneohe Bay Ocean Use Activities, Permits and Restrictions, it was stated that rules for commercial ocean use activities in Kaneohe Bay will be provided by the Kaneohe Bay Master Plan until applicable rules consist with the Master Plan are adopted by the Department, Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation, DLNR. In July 2016, the Commercial Committee of the Kaneohe Bay Regional Council posted the recommendations to specify that Holokai Tours, the commercial component of Kamaʻaina Kids, operating in Kaneohe Bay, is considered a commercial entity. Within the context of the master plan, further, most of the committee believe that Holokai Tours does not qualify as an educational entity, but a minority did believe it. The existing rules are ubiquitous and have been interpreted differently by commercial vendors, including Kamaaina Kids. On May 24, 2019, this board denied the administrative hearing requested by Kamaaina Care Incorporated regarding their non-renewal of Kanioi Bay Water's commercial use permit. Kamaaina Care Incorporated commercial activities violated the terms of the commercial use permit, did not comply with the permit limitations or the rules and regulations for the use of Kanioi Bay as stipulated by the Kanioi Bay Master Plan. Since Ahamoku became attached to the LNR in 2013, we have worked well with the LNR, including Dobor, on all the islands, including Kakuhihewa, Oahu. A strong level of trust and collaboration was developed, one that we truly treasure. Because of that trust, we must share our concerns about the ambiguity of the definition of commercial ocean activities in Kanioi Bay. Trust needs to be back with the people because there's a lot of mistrust right now that's going on in our communities. We understand after reviewing the different Hawaii administrative rules under Chapter 13, Section 256, which pertains to the Pacific Ocean activities in Kanioi Bay, that some of the descriptive language as listed is necessarily ambiguous and has indeed led to community conflicts, which was not intended to do. We believe that the request of Dobor to initiate rulemaking proceedings, including public hearing, that will clarify commercial ocean activities in Kanioi Bay is clearly needed and should be approved. Ahamoku strongly supports and recommends the request for approval to initiate rulemaking proceedings, including public hearings, to amend HR 13-256-73, Kanioi Bay Waters to clarify commercial activity provisions be approved.
Thank you.
Yeah, mahalo and mahalo for your long years of service.
Other public testimony? Okay. No further testimony. Does somebody want to make a motion?
I have questions of staff.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
So the submittal says that basically it says bona fide non-profit educational use is covered by other sections, and it lists a whole bunch of other sections, and I'm trying to look at those sections right now.
Sure, it starts with 256.73.2. It spells it out in 73.2, 73.3, 73.4, 73.5, etc. It goes on because it breaks down the types of permits that were permitted within the Kanioi Bay Master Plan, which is full service permits, large snorkel tour permits, small sails, snorkel permits, and glass bottom boats. So there's a provision in there that allows for these companies that hold the permits to take out not-for-profit educational tours, like for example, like the glass bottom boat taking students to Coconut Island, and it wouldn't be counted against their regular daily passenger permits. Oh.
Do they get to charge the students, or is that a bright line of it's, charge versus no charge? How do you determine what's commercial and what's not commercial?
It's clear inside there that they can't charge for more than fuel and labor costs.
Okay. And what about, say, an organization that doesn't have a commercial permit but wants to do some kind of educational activity in the bay, and they're bona fide nonprofit? What is the bright line for determining? Mr. Picard was talking about a loophole, you know, where they charge for it. But on the other hand, I can see why, you know, you could have, I could see somebody having a program where, say you have a program on the bay and like kids are say, Kokokahi, you charge kids for some kind of program that they go after school, a couple hundred a month, and you take them out on the bay. Is that commercial? How does that fit into it? And I would say, you know, I can see legitimate programs that involve payment of money that to me are educational and should be not regulated by the way the commercial activities are. But I can also see how we can create a loophole that you could, you know, drive a tour bus through.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely difficult. From my understanding, that, for example, when Kamaaina Kids was over at Kokokahi, it was just, you know, students, kids going out. And, I mean, I have their breakdown of what they were particularly using back in, you know, in 93. They only had 30 decals that were issued to them back in 1993. Now they have 67. What that means in passenger counts could be that it was a lot less. So I think it's hard to answer your question about what would be considered not-for-profit educational. The only permit that we have in our rules that we can issue is a commercial use permit. We don't have anything in our rules specifically as a not-for-profit educational type of permit. I'm not sure if that's really answers your question.
Well, so what makes you...
The purpose of the fuel and labor cost limitation is to ensure that it's not a for-profit.
Correct, and so that it would be covered underneath the existing permits within Kahului Bay, which are the large snorkel. Mm-hmm. And inside the master plan, I mean, it's specific, it has the 12 companies at the time that they generated this master plan. And so these were the only permit holders specifically within Kahului Bay. Kamaaina Kids or Kamaaina Care was never mentioned in this particular master plan.
So I get, I don't know if you're
done. I'm done for now.
Okay,
I'm still thinking, but yeah, go ahead.
So I get the ambiguity caused by commercial operators who are trying to find a loophole for profit. I get that. In the case of a registered educational institution, one with proper students and kids, I'm really asked about their question. How did they seek relief for the KPI that they serve in the interim if rule changes go by? I'm assuming rule changes take some time, right? They take time. Maybe it's an easy question, but during that time, do the rules stay in place? How long is that time? And then during the time when you actually have schools or educational facilities, and I hear the point that there are 12 or 15 people that were identified in the master plan, but also since that time, there's other types of nonprofit schools and charter schools that have arisen since that time that I think have very good curriculum that engage their students with our resources. So I don't know if we can answer that question right now, but how do they seek respite for those that are really, and again, maybe it's not Kamaaina Kids, maybe it's another school that needs to access this for educational purposes.
Hawaii Pacific University building.
Yeah.
There's a cabin, right?
Well, let's say Punanaleo wants to go out there. That's an educational facility that needs access to those resources for X reason.
We have in the past, like for example, we work very closely with Polynesian Voyaging Society, and we've worked with schools that do, you know, they'll do like a kayak event or they'll go out on a particular boat like the Voyaging Society. We've issued a marine event permit, which basically gives them the ability to hold an event or a regatta on the ocean waters. And so they have an actual permit for that particular time that they're going out and doing something. So we have that ability to do that. But if you're looking for some type of permit that we would issue year-round to an entity to do something like that, we don't have.
Well, I don't think I was offering a solution at any point.
Yeah.
I was just curious as to, I'm understanding the loophole, I get it again. It's just when it comes to a specific educational legitimate one that has kids, which is really what we should be looking at, kids, educating them the best that we can, more than or outside of our classroom, how are we supporting that, or how are we going to support that?
The Merivale Foundation does it also in its language and the master plan that accommodates it. Yeah, it might even be in the rules. The Merivale Foundation itself will.
From Bella County of the Bay.
Oh. Okay.
Okay, other questions? Any other questions? Nope.
Other public testimony?
There's no more testimony. Board members?
I would move to accept staff recommendation.
Okay. Is there a second on that?
A second.
Okay. Further discussion?
I think that there's a lot of complexity involved in this and history as well. I thank those people that stepped forward to indicate some of that history. And the nature of the mechanisms behind the rulemaking change, and so I believe that this the best way to deal with it is to take it to public hearing, air those information out, and see about trying to streamline what has been a history of change in the rules regarding the use of Kane Ohebe.
Okay, other comments? Yeah, Tommy.
What I feel is that P and Q was specifically put there. P is to address the commercial activity, commercial users at that time. And Q was to say that these guys get the nonprofit, get the right to operate, not as a commercial user, but a non-profit organization. Yeah. And that's my interpretation.
I'm sorry, can I have 5 minutes to look at something before we, 3 minutes to look at something
okay,
before
okay.
we
go?
Okay, really short sorry. Break.
Okay.
Yeah. 12:20 break.